We'll wait a couple minutes on some folks, but I just, while we wait for some folks who are just coming in, because I know there's always more. I just want to take a little survey. How many of you, this is your first time attending the conference? Finishing a doctorate here at SES. Coming from a background in design and marketing, I've been fascinated with imagery and its use to manipulate people. Because, to be quite blunt, if you spend any time in advertising, you learn how wonderful Photoshop can be at manipulating others towards a certain end. And it's really no different with some of the memes that we see on Facebook and social media. I actually participate in a secret group on Facebook, and all we do is analyze anti-Christian memes and imagery. And we kick it around ourselves. We do it for fun. And there's a lot of eye-rolling that goes on. But there's a common thread that runs through all of it. And we're going to discuss a little bit of that today. And so I want to talk just a little bit briefly on the effect of what we post, what it means to others, how should Christians conduct themselves online. There are good ways and some not so good. And are there any tools that we can use to kind of separate fact from fiction? And there's one important note I make coming up here about the power of imagery, and that's kind of what this discussion turns on today. And then here's actually what we're going to discuss. And it looks like a lot, but they're just short chunks of information. Teaching a group like this, I like to kind of chunk my information into these points that sort of connect the dots for everyone, and I hope it won't be like a fire hose to the face. It really shouldn't be. Okay, a lot of this is common sense. A lot of it relates to some of the things we've been taught in church, or perhaps haven't been taught in church, or haven't been reminded in church. And so there will come a portion today where I will encourage comments on some of the nonsense that we're about to look at. Okay. I hope it's as fun as I'm anticipating. So we'll take a brief look at why people in general post what they do on Facebook. A lot of it depends on how they identify and who they identify with, what sort of group in our culture. Very briefly, we're going to cover the three basic laws of logic. Was anyone in Frank Turek's opening today? Did any of you sit in there? Okay. This is just a brief review of what he said. Thanks to him, I can move on to some other things quickly. I like the way that builds today. We're going to review the basic attributes of God. This is mostly the things that we've all learned in church, but I want us all on the same page as we look at these memes. Okay. Two important doctrines to remember. A brief look at the Trinity and how we understand the Trinity, because it can be very common for misconceptions and some very bad analogies or illustrations that I myself am guilty of in the past. And because I've committed that mistake, I will encourage you not to follow in my footsteps. Okay? We're going to talk just briefly of things I've noticed of seven issues that sort of pop up when atheists attempt to discuss Christianity. And then we'll have a handful of memes to look at, varying degrees of. Some of them are attempt to be insulting to Christianity, but it's really nonsense when it comes down to it. And finally, just a few closing comments and a couple of tips on how to, if you do wish to jump into rebutting a meme that someone posts online, some good behavior and how you can avoid inflaming an argument. Okay. Now, the word meme, I think everyone's heard this, but Richard Dawkins, whose name gets mentioned frequently at this conference, okay, he's actually an evolutionary biologist. And he coined this term over 40 years ago when he was discussing DNA and how, in his view, animals are driven to reproduce their DNA. And so his words, memetics, actually referred to the transfer of genes. And then Daniel Dennett, who also gets mentioned early, or mentioned around here, he was mentioned in Frank's discussion. He took the word that described genes and moved it to ideas that happen in culture. And so the idea of a meme is similar to a virus. It goes through culture, and it spreads around and carries an impact with it. So why do people share memes? Now, this is kind of fascinating, and I won't bring up the phrase virtue signaling today at all. I promise. I made myself purposely not put that phrase in here because I have a feeling in about a year and a half, people are going to hate that phrase. And so I wanted a little lifespan to this recording here. So if you're listening down the road, that's why I didn't put that phrase in here. Excuse me. First of all, a lot of times we post things that we feel are important, that we'd like others to view as important. That seems pretty basic. And there is a PDF of this slideshow on the SES app, by the way. Just a lot of times people express emotions. For example, in the wake of the Las Vegas shootings, you see an outpouring of grief, hope, and support. People will throw these things out there. Also, when it relates to identity, okay, coming up here, we'll see there's a reason people wish to be identified with some of these memes. Maybe calling others to action, all right? There's an implied you ought to be doing this as well. They're trying to encourage others to act. Sometimes people post memes to either encourage or discontinue a conversation. If someone has an opposite view, a lot of times they'll post something sarcastically to throw you off base a little bit. One of the things that comes up, and you'll see in these memes, there's what's called the layers of communication. And I'll break that down here shortly, what I mean by layers of communication. And some people just like to post stuff that looks good. I have an associate who loves to post fine art every night before she goes to bed. And it's kind of refreshing as a way, some of the things. And then reasons that memes go viral, these are from various studies. Okay, the first obvious one is humor. People think something is funny. So they will repost it in the hopes that others will get their sense of humor. A lot of times to provoke emotions, good and bad, establish sympathy or empathy. There are times when someone posts a meme in order to convey what they feel is an accurate image of themselves as an authority. Excuse me. They want to be conveyed or portrayed or portray themselves as someone who knows. Okay. I know this, and I'm not sure you do, but I want you to know that I know this kind of thing. And that goes hand in hand with the other idea of who you are. Maybe not you, maybe someone you interact with. But to have others say, so that others see you say, I'm part of this group, I'm not part of that group. So you can either like me or dislike me because I am with this group. And we see a lot of that with political aspects of memes. Another possibility is to have pull up alongside who someone may not know you very well, and so that they will join you together as either comrades or friends, that you're united together for this particular view of something. Now here's the multiple layers of meaning, and this is fascinating. A person's worldview might be Christian, might be atheist, might be Buddhist, you know. Or as studies show today, you might have people who have no worldview whatsoever in their opinion. We call them nones, right? N-O-N-E-S. Their worldview impacts how that they will recognize an image. And the images we see can have multiple layers of meaning. And what I mean by that, if you're a parent or an older sibling, excuse me, and you've sat through a Disney movie or any cartoon on TV, there may be a joke that slides right over the heads of the little ones in the room, and you recognize that's an adult joke. They miss it, but I get it, right? This is where you find bits of humor of, excuse me, I'm so sorry. you find these bits of adult humor layered in, and so images are the same way. There may be multiple layers of information within an image that you just may not be familiar with. Sometimes it's encoded. That's why memes can be powerful at eliciting emotions. All right? And the simple fact is there may be others who interpret meanings in images that we don't see. Okay? Now, this is the point I'd like to kind of rest on for a moment. When you're scrolling down your social media page, whether it's Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or whatever, your eye will be attracted by a picture or an image more than a block of text. Okay, that's just a fact of the way our brain responds to things. And so information combined by, or information that proceeds out as an image is digested more easily than something you have to think over. And that's why memes are powerful with their imagery, because you may not, you, that includes me, we may not think correctly when we see an image at first, and it may cause an emotional reaction, when deep down, if you really stop and unpack what's going on, you'll see that it really is nothing. Okay, and I just want you to think about that for a minute. The images you share on Facebook or other social media, Instagram, Snapchat, whatever, may be more powerful than the words you say. And that part of that is our culture as well. And when you think of just watching a normal football game on a Saturday or Sunday, the types of images that are thrown your way, even between every play, if you're watching an SEC game or a Big Ten game, you'll have the logo spiral in between every single play. Constant bombardment of images. All right. Finally, and this is for someone who may be unsure about their beliefs. If a person's unsure about what they believe, that can actually be reinforced by responses to what you post. That's a sense of community that develops online. As you gain acceptance from others within the group you wish to be part of, so like-minded individuals will tend to comment affirmatively. And this is a quote from a study. It says, identification, or who a person identifies as, plays a much more important role as personal social identity. I'm like them. I'm one of them. Now, ironically, if you're a Christian, you're considered in Christ. You now have his identity because there's neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek. Okay, we all have his identity. Okay, we take that identity at salvation. Okay, that's just something to keep in the back of your head as we work through this. Now, the basic laws of logic, this is not a very technical talk. This is a very basic form here. There's only three. There's a law of identity. We'll use this object just because there's others like it in here. Law of identity. Law of non-contradiction, with Frank, which Frank Turek spoke about this morning. Law of the excluded middle. And they're very basic. Interesting thing is, I have grandkids now. They're very little, but I'm now that I'm older and I'm not fussing with either making bottles or diapering or just trying to get sleep, you know, I can love them and give them back, sort of thing. And it's fascinating to watch their brain develop. And I'm anticipating certain things coming up. And children, intuitively, it seems, learn the basic laws of logic, and I'll explain that coming up here. Law of identity is very simple. This is taken from a talk by J.P. Moreland. Okay? If we use the sentence, it's raining, and that sentence describes the actual weather outside, the statement is true. In a simplified version, this bottle is this bottle. Okay? That's pretty basic. This bottle is this bottle. Okay? This even makes it sound more convoluted. Everything is itself and not something else. Well, this bottle is not that bottle. So there's our law of non-contradiction. If we use the sentence, it is raining, it cannot be true and false in the same sense. Now, it might be raining here and not, say, in Charleston, South Carolina, but we're talking about right here, right now, when we're talking this instant. All right? So backing up, law of non-contradiction, if this is your bottle of water and that is someone else's bottle of water, we have this natural urge not to drink from that because we know the identity of this bottle. Right? You don't want to drink someone's backwash, right? This is basic. This is our basic thought life, right? But there are actually laws of this. And finally, the law of the excluded middle. If we use the sentence, it's raining, it's either true or false, and it can't be anything other than true or false. That's pretty simple. This bottle is not that bottle, but it can't be this bottle and that bottle at the same time either. I know that seems very basic. But when we take that and apply it to the members of the Trinity, that's okay.
I feel like I'm a little distracted. I came to the wrong class. I'm sorry.
That's all right. No problem at all. All right. Some of these are a review, but I want us all on the same page before we go any farther. Okay. Our basic attributes of God, right? Genesis 1:1 and in Exodus 3:14 as well. God is eternal. Fairly basic. We all know that one, right? He is uncreated. As we'll see here, you'd be surprised that people don't know this, but they don't. And that's, in some ways, it's sad, but it's to be expected in our culture. Omniscient, all-knowing. Omnipotent, all-powerful. Omnipresent, all places. We're all on the same page. It's all basic, right? Outside of time or atemporal would be the technical word. I try not to get too much into technical stuff here. Right, Genesis 1:1 clearly establishes God is outside of time. He was before there is time. Time, space, matter, and energy. So he's atemporal. He is sovereign. No problem there. We're all on the same page. Unchanging. Psalms go into that quite a bit. Jesus said he is spirit. The technical word would be immaterial. He has no physical body. Neither do the laws of logic, by the way. They're immaterial. And then a word that pops up around SES and typically in philosophy. He's necessary. For each of us in here, if our parents had never met, we wouldn't be here. That means we're contingent. Our existence is completely dependent on the fact that our parents met, right? So we are contingent beings, and it is possible for us to never exist. Okay. God, however, being eternal, uncreated, he's what philosophers would refer to as necessary. He's the first cause of everything. He cannot not be. I remember the first time I tried to wrestle with this when I was a young teenager. You talk about messing somebody up. Just trying to roll it in your head how God could be eternal when, you know, if you've only been alive 12 or 13 years, it's hard to comprehend eternal, you know, especially when you lose a family member and you realize you aren't, in the sense of this, you aren't necessary, and you too eventually will cease to exist in bodily form. So, okay, we're all on the same page here, right? As we move along? I thought so. But it's good to have a little refresher. And these are not the only attributes of God. They're just the ones we happen to be using today. Aha. Now, this is where the fun starts. A good old Trinity. I know lots of friends who like to just play the mystery card when it comes to the Trinity. But I want to give you a simple phrase that will help you understand the Trinity better than any illustration. And I'm going to discuss a couple of illustrations here. This doesn't work. And this is the problem you'll see in a lot of Muslim criticism. Right? Well, first of all, if you've ever had first grade math, you know that three persons can't be one person. The law of identity and the law of non-contradiction, even though you can't name them in first grade, you know that if you have three packages of Capri Sun, that's not the same as having one package of Capri Sun, right? Or three brownies compared to one brownie, you know, or three Barbies compared to one Barbie. It just doesn't make sense. And so you'll see people at times, and there's, you'll run into this issue when speaking with not Muslims, they want to say three persons in one person. Well, that just doesn't work, right? The correct term, five-word phrase to describe the Trinity, is three persons in one essence. Okay? Now, the easy way to describe an essence, it comes from a Greek word, ousia, which just means the properties of a thing. So three persons who all share the properties or attributes that we just studied, right? There are no other persons who share those divine attributes. Now, a great example of an essence, okay, that's a very philosophical word. This is the only philosophical word I'm going to lay on you today, okay? A great way to understand essence that's been encoded into international law, if you look at the trial of Nuremberg, okay, when the Nazi war criminals were tried by judges from the United States, France, Britain, and Russia, they were charged and convicted of crimes against humanity. Humanity is an example of an essence. These war criminals were tried on the basis that they violated and caused injury to something common to all of us that we all have, that is somehow valuable, even if you can't put your finger on it, that we all share. We all share this essence of humanity. And so the three persons of the Godhead share an essence only among themselves. By the law of non-contradiction, if someone attempts to describe a God and it contradicts what the attributes are to the Godhead, you are no longer talking about the Godhead. You're moving from this bottle to that bottle instantly. And we'll see that in a meme coming up here, several of them actually. And this is, yes, sir?
When you were talking about three persons, that implies like a separateness, but could you say beings, which may be more generic?
Okay, let's open that can of worms, okay?
Yeah.
Because
that's where I would have an issue is
right.
Persons are an individuality.
Yes.
An individuality.
Yes. I know some people who say three persons in one being, and I shy away from that. I realize persons has a human connotation to it. That's where some of the drawback may be. But if you go into the realm of theology, this is what you're going to find. And this is actually what the early church used in the early creeds. Okay. Excellent question. Thank you. And anyone else that wants to jump in, please. All right. Now, this is the thing that tripped me up about 12 years ago in Awana. I was teaching Awana. I had a 9-year-old ask me, I think he just graduated a year or two ago. He said, how can Jesus be fully God and fully man? And I realized at that time, if you can't explain your theology to a 9-year-old, you should either get to work or get out, right? Isn't it amazing? Well, now, after a few degrees later and a much thinner wallet, I can help you guys along with how this goes today. But it's actually it's not as hard as you might think. Now, you can make an entire career talking about this, but in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, they use the word hypostasis, the author uses, and that just means in one place. He's attempting to show how Jesus can be fully God and fully man, so we give it a fancy name like hypostatic union. Let me help with a little illustration here. We have our members of the Trinity, co-equal, co-eternal, right? Three separate persons. They all share the same attributes together that we would call an essence. Three persons that all share these similarities that they don't share with anyone or anything else. The Word says, the Word became flesh. We have the second member of the Trinity that took on a human body, right? Only the second member of the Trinity, right? And the early church, based on the scriptures, came up with a couple conclusions. Jesus has two natures, human and divine. Another substitute would be essence. Okay? Two essences to Jesus, his humanity, his divinity. They're not really synonyms, but for today, they're good enough to get by here. Okay? Jesus also had two wills. Let this cup pass from me. Okay? That sounds like someone who isn't prepared for what's about to happen. That's where this idea comes from, two wills. In one person. There were fist fights over this stuff in the early churches. Your homework assignment is to go see why St. Nicholas punched somebody in the face. And it's that St. Nicholas, yes. The same one that Santa Claus is based on. All right. So knowing that God is eternal and unchanging, can God die? No. To die is to change. So what happened on the cross here? What aspect of this two-natured, unique individual could die on a cross? The human body. Now what did Jesus say at the Last Supper? This is my body broken for you. Now this is a very simple unpacking of the idea. Okay? Because really, I mean, how much more can we do here? You could take an entire course on how God became man, and I do want you guys to get out of here on time, right? But you can see that it can be difficult to understand, but there is a level we can at least reach up and grasp that low-hanging fruit, right? And this kind of clears things up. Now, here's the problem with using an illustration, and I made these mistakes, okay? Especially when it comes to the Trinity. If you've ever seen someone use an illustration of water, ice, and steam, hey, here's the problem. That's actually an early heresy. It's an early heresy called modalism. Perhaps you've heard someone try to describe the Trinity as an egg, shell, white, and yolk. That's an early heresy too as well. That's because that's actually called partialism. Each member of the Godhead is 100% fully God, not 33, 33, and 33. Remember, God doesn't have a body, so you can't count percentages like one-third, one-third, one-third. That doesn't apply to something that is spirit. And this is the part that, yes, can mess with your head, but it's messed with everyone else's head that's tried to think of it. But we can at least grab that low-hanging fruit and take it from me so you won't be making this mistake in the future. Just don't use those sorts of illustrations. If you dig down to it, there's something wrong with this illustration too. That's because we're trying to use something visual to describe something that can't be seen. So already there's a problem in there when we just put a slideshow together. That being said, we could drop anchor here and be depressed, or we can move on to the fun stuff. Okay. But these are seven things that I've found in discussions with atheists. You're free to use these any way you want. These are just things that I have collected over the years. It's the things that makes me raise an eyebrow from time to time. Atheists tend to judge God as somehow wrong. Oh, it was bad for God to kill those Canaanite children. You hear that about the Old Testament, okay? Second one, they will point out some aspect of the Old Testament, especially the law, right? Well, do you know that in the Old Testament it says so-and-so can be stoned if they do such-and-such? Right? Right. Yes, no ear piercings, no tattoos. The irony of the law, if you look in Deuteronomy, there's a little tiny law that says you will not wear clothing of two mixed types of fiber. So if you guys got up put on socks or Fruit of the Looms today, you've now broken the law. Okay? You are not to wear clothing made of two types of fiber. So if you have spandex and cotton and polyester in your clothes, guess what? You have broken the law before God, and now you're unfit to stand in His presence. That's a big deal. That's why grace is so important. And there's 612 others of those that you better be paying attention to and not cherry-picking from. Now, I will be generous enough to say that sometimes Christians do cherry pick. But I would encourage a study in just how powerful grace is. Grace is terribly humbling when you really dig into it. All right. They also attempt to manipulate emotions. Well, I can't believe that you would agree with these people, right? That sort of thing. And, of course, the appeal to authorities, science, logic, and knowledge. Well, you know. Well, Richard Carrier says Jesus never existed, and I believe him. Well, okay, right? Richard Carrier is about the only PhD in the entire known world who denies the existence of Jesus. Okay, now he may be right, but the evidence is against him. But his background isn't history, it's actually Greek classics. Have you ever, and a lot of times you'll hear anger. I have a friend. I used to work in a record store years ago. We liked some of the same music, and he's an anti-theist by this point. He is so angry. He grew up in Texas in a church that was, the pastor was a disciple of a well-known fundamentalist preacher from Indiana that I won't name. Okay? I see some grins from the folks who might know who I'm talking about. This pastor actually had affairs with several of the married women in the church in Texas. So my friend is equating the actions of a pastor. He's kind of transferred those over to God. And so guilty by association are all we Christians because of this man's hypocrisy. And he's very angry. Now, this is one that you'll hear. It's very subtle. God is somehow owes us something. Well, if God is all-powerful and God is all-loving, why didn't he stop the shooter from shooting those people in Las Vegas? Right? As if God owes us something. And you'll hear that buried in the things they say. It might be very subtle. And finally, I'll leave this up there because I know some of you are writing. They just don't know. Bless their hearts. And I get kind of frustrated with that. But on the same token, and I'm not trying to be pernicious here, okay? If you've ever taught in a youth ministry, how many times have you ever seen the Trinity or the hypostatic union described for our little kids to understand? So I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just trying. This is one of the things, you know, I'm involved with in my church. We look at curriculum and we say, well, okay, I get the sense they are trying to impart a good sense of moral rightness and wrongness and behavior to our kids, but there's got to be something more than don't listen to this music and listen to this music kind of stuff going on. Okay, and I promise to get off this soapbox as soon as I see folks finishing taking their notes here. I want to get to the fun stuff where we all look at the absurdity of things that may seem to smack us in the face at first. Okay, any questions or anything? Because we're making good time. We're going to be out of here on time. And mercifully, this room has some air conditioning. I was in one this morning that I felt was 90 degrees. A friend of mine had to stand up there and sweat, and it wasn't because the stuff he was saying was so inflammatory. All right. Here's the audience participation. Normally, this is where the carbs kick in from your lunch. So I would try to paint myself as someone who had the foresight to put this in here, but let's not go that far, okay? Now, this first one is very basic. You only have to know the attributes of God. Okay? And that's actually, you'd be surprised how common that question is. Okay? All right, now let's look for a layer of meaning in there. Granted, the meme has run its course. You have the raptor that looks as if it's intrigued by a question, right? But what's the other subtle implication of a raptor contemplating God? Yeah. Exactly. That was good. It's a subtle hint at naturalism or evolution, right? So you have multiple layers of meaning here. And that meaning may pass us by, but there's a definite point there. Okay. Frank Turek brought this up this morning. I think this is an album cover, actually. Here's the law of non-contradiction. On most moral attributes, most ideas of morality, that's where religions are the same, right? I have a young man that comes to our Ratio Christi group I'm associate director at Marshall University in Huntington. Go Herd, yeah. I have a young man who professes to be a Buddhist. Okay. Now, Buddhism is essentially atheism wrapped in a lot of slogans. Because the ultimate aim of Buddhism is to become nothing. You really have no value, and you only have the perception of value, and you need to get rid of that idea from your life, and life will get a lot easier. That's essentially it. But again, this is what Frank is talking about. They can't all be true. Now, they can all be false, but that's why we have these conferences here, to take a look at that asterisk that's by one person in particular here, right? Okay. This kind of stuff. All right. Now, this is just a confusion of the Trinity, right? Because they're making the mistake, three persons in one person, right? Oh, they get better. They get better. I saved from a couple of them. I promise not to. Okay. Again, here we have one that confuses attributes, Christian theology, and hypostatic union, Trinity. This one is just a whole bucket full, okay? But we're going to unpack it, and I'm going to correct it, and we'll go on our merry way. Okay. God sacrificed himself to himself to appease himself and therefore save humanity from himself. It's a very condescending view, right? Right? There's this big cosmic meanie that lives above us. Okay. Now they have confused a number of things here, right? They have confused the idea of three persons with one person. Right? They have no concept of three persons that bear the same set of properties, the one essence that makes the Godhead the Godhead. All right? They don't understand exactly why Jesus died on the cross. They don't understand the notion of atonement. So here we have, and I'm being kind when I say this, and I don't mean this word the negative way, this just shows ignorance of Christianity itself. And there's no knowledge, there's no education there. And I have to watch myself using that word in front of college students at times. And I don't mean it in the bad way. I'm really meaning you seem to be unstudied on the matter. Here's something to study so you won't be unstudied on the matter. That's really what I'm implying. But the word really has another meaning when it just pops out, right? And it can be taken. So let's correct this for this meme writer. Okay. All right. God sacrificed the body of Christ. We just went over that, didn't we? Okay. There was something unique about the union that Jesus, even being divine, could sense that pain. Okay. This is the extent when you study the incarnation, how deep you can go with it. But anyway, God sacrificed the body of Christ to pay man's sin debt and therefore save humanity from themselves. We can't save ourselves, right? So with just a simple understanding, we have just put this thing to bed, right? It's purely nonsense from someone who just doesn't know. But to read it, remember that idea of images carrying weight? To see that scroll up your news feed, that can make you go, wait, what? All right. Now this is one of my favorite buddies here. Because I've heard a lot of people go on and on. Makes perfect sense. All right. I had to throw that in at the end. If you can explain it correctly, and we've only been at it 15 minutes, and we've already deconstructed a major error-filled meme here, right? Just some simple, basic truths about that I really hope we can start teaching our youngest members of our churches here before long. All right. This one's kind of different, but we're going to throw it out there for the laws of logic. All right. Some of these are just you start to feel bad for the folks who post this stuff. All right. The first known photograph was dated about 1826 or 1827. Napoleon Bonaparte died in 1821. Did he exist? How many pictures can you take of the laws of logic? Remember, in order to have this discussion, you have to assume the laws of logic exist, and you can't conduct a scientific experiment to prove they exist. Yes, sir?
Couldn't you with this one also really just flip it backwards and say, dear science, make certain it happens, it's purely religion?
Yes, because along those lines, how many pictures do we have of the origin of life?
Right.
How many pictures do we have of the origin of the universe, you know? So I understand the intent, the execution, though. It falls apart under its own weight. It just really falls apart under its own weight. And you can flip it back on itself, as the gentleman said. So this leads into the whole idea of philosophy of history, too. That's a whole other... Maybe I should do that next year. I don't know. All right. And we're right on time here. This is good. This is an old friend of mine. Who is this? The Flying Spaghetti Monster. Okay, let's just ask a couple questions here. Without this, there isn't even, I don't even have a meme attached to this. I want to point something out. Whenever you encounter our noodly appendaged friend, okay? Omnipresent or one location? Is he everywhere or just one place? He's just one place. Physical body or immaterial? All right, so already the idea of the Flying Spaghetti Monster has violated two of the attributes of God. And once you contradict the attributes of God, you have ceased to talk about God. It's that simple. You are no longer describing this thing that we in our finite minds refer to as God, and you're now describing that thing, which is an idea someone dreamed up who didn't have a firm idea of the attributes of this thing or this people or this entity we call God. So already it just falls apart before you even see an argument made from the Flying Spaghetti Monster. I need a t-shirt. I should have worn a t-shirt of him today. There you go. Yeah, I should do that in my next driver's license picture. Yes, there are... There are followers of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. He's referring to, there are people who wear colanders on their head as a sign of their belonging to this religion, if you will, to strain the noodles. All right. So, but you can see once you, the simple basic tools of logic, the simple attributes of God, the basics of the Trinity and how Jesus can be fully God and fully man, 98% of this stuff just falls apart. All right. Now, this next one is rather abrupt. Okay. But within 15 seconds, you'll see it as word salad, all right? It's someone who thinks they're being clever, and I'm going to be generous with that description, okay? I'm going to let you wade through that, and if you can't read it, I'll read it. God can't exist because of Eric the God-eating magic penguin. Since Eric is God-eating by definition, he has no choice but to eat God. So if God exists, he automatically ceases to exist as a result of being eaten. Unless you can prove that Eric doesn't exist, God doesn't exist. Even if you can prove that Eric doesn't exist, that same proof will be applicable to God. There are only two possibilities. Either you can prove that Eric doesn't exist or you can't. In both cases, it logically follows that God doesn't exist. That's beyond Waldorf salad right there, right? I mean, that's just a lot of effort went into this. Of course, my mind starts to wander now. If Eric the Penguin is God eating, and God has no body, well, there's his first problem, right? Eric's going to starve a little bit, but this now we're in the now I'm in the point of well how did Eric come to be if there's only one God to eat and he's already eaten that God? Does Eric now cease to exist if he's eat? See, this is the nonsense. But just really, I think if you become a philosophy student, this is sophistry, right? This is nonsense. This is nonsense parading as if it's something deeply intellectual, right? This is why you have to pray for some of these folks too. Look how much time went into trying to wrestle illogic into something that almost makes sense, but man. Okay, that's as bad as it gets in here. But now I would just want to be an equal opportunity offender, and I have seen some Christians post this one. Okay, because this is actually not a description of atheism. This is more of a description of scientific naturalism. Now, it might entail an atheistic belief, but this is like, I'm like your friendly mentor here. Don't do this, right? Yeah, because we're lowering ourselves to another standard that we don't have to. Okay, because that's really not atheism. All right, here's our closing comments. This is what's funny. If you've ever noticed someone online who tries to cultivate their image to be something they're not, the funny thing is, over time, they'll actually portray themselves correctly. Like, based on what photos they take or what stuff they upload. Over time, though, okay, even when they try to be selective with what they post, their true self will come out online. Okay. So there is a chance to use social media for good. Tremendous opportunity for good does exist. Okay. You can use social media for good. You know, basically, are we bringing glory to God with what we post? Okay, knowing what we've looked through already. Are we tearing others down or building up? Are we trying to win an argument, or do we have genuine concern for the person that we're talking to? This is basic apologetics right here. And this is for the older folks in the room. Everyone under 25 can shut your ears. If you preach at our young people in church on Sunday morning, and then next Saturday night you post pictures of you at the bar drinking with your friends, and your face buried in a woman's chest. Okay? Youngsters, our youngest Christians watch closely for hypocrisy. And they will see it every single time. Okay? It's as if between the ages of birth and 25, the hypocrisy meter is just finely tuned for the people who are trying to instruct them. Okay, and do we take time to edify others, encourage, or listen? You know, it's real easy to be a jerk sometime, especially if you've had a bad day. Okay, it's harder to be kind sometime. It's harder to be encouraging, and it's harder sometimes to post the truth. Okay, without, there's a lot of times we want to post the truth and we have this timidity about offending someone. Maybe it should be done in a private conversation and not in public. There's things we have to think about. So let's talk about quickly about rebuttals. If you see someone posting this nonsense, here's the best way to handle it, okay? Because you're leaving yourself open when you post a rebuttal. People are going to come after you. Okay? Instead of pointing out the error by the person who posted it, point out the error in the person who created the meme. And use this phrase. It appears that the author of this meme has confused or misunderstood or, all right, put the guilt on the person who created the thing. Okay, don't put it on the person who posted it. All right, you may still get an earful or blocked, but, you know, you took the moral high road, so to speak. Okay, so if you want to further understand, because we just scratched the basics of logic, the next thing to look for is logical fallacies. That's that's what Frank dealt with today. the idea of the self-refuting statement. That's actually a fallacy in logic. All right. Some great encouragement. Don't be children in our thinking. You know, trying to reason through the Trinity and the hypostatic union is hard work. But remember, Paul encourages us frequently to grow in wisdom of the Lord. And when you actually spend time studying, that's actually an act of worship. Because think of how you could be spending your time. Okay, if you take the time to read a book or to grow in knowledge of the Lord, grow in your apologetics, right, ministering to others, that's time that could be spent doing nothing. So consider it an act of worship. Okay. So any questions or comments today? Any thoughts? I mean, we covered a large portion of ground, but by the time we were done, we made it to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and we all made it in one piece, didn't we?
Could you speak,
sure. Yes.
But what's some things that you talked to about, just as adults real quick?
Well,
as far as from a pastoral perspective.
Right, from a pastoral perspective, the question I would ask is, when you respond to this person, are you responding and placing them under law, or are you encouraging them in grace? That's the big question. Because we all know what happens when we put somebody under law. You know, you tell a little kid, when I was 3, my dad told me, do not touch this lawnmower, it is hot. The blister on my hand got about that big, right? Because when you put someone under law, what's the first instinct they want to do? I'm going to go do it. So it's a matter of grace. And if you read Paul's letters, he when he encourages people to stop doing what they're doing, he said, he reminds them again of their identity. You were this Gentile. Now you're in Christ. You have his identity. And coming to know your knowledge and position in Christ, you know, you have been made righteous. Your legal standing before God is good. Nothing can be accounted against you. Now you're in the sanctification process, because people confuse these two. Now this is the part where trials come against you to make you more Christ-like. This is where we slip and stumble, and people can confuse that they might go bad here, when in reality, this is part of the growing process, and we encourage our brothers and sisters who fail in this regard. So from a pastoral standpoint, it's going to be, it would be a note of encouragement. It would be like, we're lax on church discipline in this country. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but we let things slide. And I'm no fan of, because I've seen the letters written, and I've seen young people called in. And granted, there is the need, though, to point out to them, it's like just pulling up alongside and saying, hey, you know, I'm hearing that. Okay? And that may be enough to cause the embarrassment to, at least for a while, to make the behavior straighten up. I had the dearest, sweetest fourth grade teacher, and I had learned a few new words for various human body parts when I was in fourth grade. Okay, and her way of getting me to stop was she came up to me and put her arm around me and said, now, Mark, I heard you learn some new words. And she said, are those the kind of words your mom and dad would want to hear you say? That put an end to it right there. And notice it wasn't law. She didn't tell me to stop. She just, it was grace. It's like, don't you know that you're Jim and Nadine's son? And how does that reflect on them? It's all in the wording. It's all in the attitude. And it's all positive. Because Paul says, you know, this is what you used to be. There's no need to be that anymore. Okay? Because in reality, to lay down the law and tell someone to stop posting on social media, yeah, it would make them want to post more. And especially in this country, we almost feel like it's a God-given right to speak our mind. And that's where, so I would follow the advice in the New Testament, just bring them in. put your arm around them, let them understand you've heard things that are going on, and then it might have to go through the different stages. But just be gentle and firm and encouraging. That's the thing. So, yes. Any thoughts? Anything else?
What's the average lifespan of most meetings?
Very short. Yeah. Very, very short. Some of these are dated, but I needed them to prove the points what we were working for today. I would be interesting to know what they are, see how that time frame has changed. It may be just hours on some of them, I bet. Yes. Any other questions? Ma'am, do you have one? Okay.
And so, I'm trying very hard to become educated in the 21st century as a new grad student there. And one of the things that I'm finding, particularly in working with the kids, college students, in social media things, is that if you're applying chronological principles to these, they aren't.
No. What time is it? No, you're absolutely right, ma'am. There's, I actually teach a class at my church in high school apologetics, and being on staff at Marshall, so I get a range of young Christians from 15 to about 25 when you count our grad students. Now, that's an interesting age spectrum right there. And it really depends where they are in the growth and maturing process. If you have an undergrad student, their main goal is to finish and graduate, get out, get that real job, start making money, living the American dream. The minute they do that, reality sets in. If you talk to a grad student, your attitude's much different than somebody who's undergrad, right? And even someone who goes straight from undergrad, we had our former campus president has an undergrad in microbiology, got his graduate degree in teaching, left, got his first real teaching job within 6 months. The bloom was off the rose, right? And so it depends where they are in the process. And recognizing that our youngest Christians go through these phases and just sitting back and watching, because time will play a lot of these things out, because reality has a way of smacking people in the face. And if they're being ambivalent about the truth, when they get out there in the real world, it only goes so far, the nonsense of stuff. So you just may have to be waiting there, gently encouraging, and whether they listen or not, tell them what would help them. And just leave it to God's sovereignty. Especially, for example, I have children. I have grandkids now. My kids, when they were younger, I could speak till I was blue in the face to try to prove a point. Until they left the house and discovered how life really works, they had to experience it for themselves. Then and only then will some people actually wake up. And the urge is to help them not to have to go through that. But sometimes you read Paul's letters, he's like, okay, you're going to go through this and it has a purpose. So patience is key. Patience and prayer. Okay? I don't know if that helps or not, but it can be very frustrating, so I'm with you on that. Yes. Anything else?
I guess a good quote for the others from Mark Twain. As I said, he left home at 16, came home a few years later, and was amazed at how much they had
learned. Great. All right. Well, folks, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the conference. Have a safe trip home.